The Hermit by Tuesday Love Sang Grandpa, read for you by Blue Friend in beautiful BC. Chapter 6. The endless hours dragged wearily by. I lay in a stupor, a daze in which reality was not, and in which the past, the present, and the future were rolled into one. My past life, my impotent state, wherein I could neither move nor see, and my dreadful fear for my future after I got out of here, if indeed I did. From time to time, females came and did quite amazing things to me. My limbs were twisted and flexed, my head was rotated, and all portions of my anatomy were squeezed, pinched, pummeled, and kneaded. From time to time, groups of men came in and stood around me while they discussed me. I could not understand them, of course, but the inference was clear. Then, too, they would stick things in me, but I denied them the satisfaction of seeing me wince with the sharp prick. I drifted, drifted. Then came the day when I was alert once more. I had been drowsing, somnolent, as for unknown hours before. Although aware of the sliding open of the door of the room, I was not disturbed by it. I was withdrawn, feeling as though embedded in layers of wool, and not caring what happened to anyone, not even to myself. Suddenly there came a series of sharp tearing pains all around my skull. I was prodded and poked, and a voice said in my own language, "Oh, well, let us revive him." A subdued buzz, of which I was conscious only when it ceased, was terminated with a faint click. Immediately I felt alert, alive, and tried to sit up. Again I was frustrated. My most violent efforts produced no movement at all in my limbs. "He's with us again," said a voice. "Can you hear us?" asked another. "Yes, I can," I replied, "but how is it that you are speaking Tibetan? I thought that only Sir Doctor could communicate with me." There was a subdued laugh. "You are using our language," was the reply. "You will now understand everything that is said to you." Another voice broke in an aside. "What do you call him?" One whom I recognized to be the doctor answered, "Call him? Oh, we have no name for him. I just say you." "The admiral requires that he has to have a name," asserted another. "Decide how he is to be addressed." A quite animated discussion took place, during which many names were suggested. Some of them were very insulting, and indicated that to these men I enjoyed less status than that which we afforded yaks, or the vultures which fed upon the dead. Eventually, when the comments were becoming too ribald, the doctor stated, "Let us end this. The man is a monk. Let us therefore refer to him as that and call him monk." There was a moment of silence, and then spontaneous noises made with the hands, and which I rightly took to be applause. "Very well," said a voice which I had not previously heard. "Carried unanimously, here henceforth he shall bear the cognomen of monk. Let it be so recorded." A desultory discussion followed, one in which I had no interest, as it appeared that these men were discussing the virtues and lack of virtues of various of the females, and appraising the degree of ease with which they could be had. Certain of their anatomical allusions were completely beyond my comprehension, so I made no attempt to follow the trend of discussion, but contented myself with visualizing in my mind their probable appearance. Some of the men were small, and some of them were very large. Now that was a very strange thing, and one which puzzled me exceedingly, for, as far as I knew, there were no peoples on earth who possessed features and size ranges such as these men possessed. I was jerked back to the present by a sudden shuffling of feet and by what appeared to be the sliding back of those strange seats. The men stood up and one by one left the room. At last, there was only one remaining, the doctor. "Later," he said, "we shall take you again to the council chamber, the one inside the mountain. Do not be nervous, there's nothing to fear. Monk, it will be strange to you, but you will not be harmed." So saying, he too left the room, and I was alone with my thoughts again. For some extraordinary reason, one particular scene kept presenting itself to my shuddering memory. I was tied, spread-eagle fashion, against a wall. One of the Chinese torturers approached me with a fiendish smile and said, "One last chance to tell us what we want, or we will pluck out your eyes." I replied, "I'm a poor, simple monk. I have nothing to tell." With that, the Chinese torturer thrust a finger and thumb hard into the corner of my left eye, and the eye popped out like a stone from a plum. It hung dangling on my cheek. The pain of the distorted vision was terrible. The right eye, as yet intact, looked straight ahead. The left eye, swaying and dangling on my cheek, looked straight down. The mental impressions were terrible. Then, with a quick jerk, the Chinaman tore the eye free and threw it in my face, before giving the same treatment to the right. I remembered how at last, satiated with their orgy of torture, they had thrown me out on a garbage heap. But I was not dead, as they believed. The coolness of the night had revived me, and I had wandered off, blindly, stumbling, until at last some sense had led me from the Chinese mission grounds and eventually out of the city of Lhasa. With such thoughts, I lost all track of time, and it was somewhat of a relief when at last men came to my room. Now I could understand what was said. A special lifting device, something with the strange name of anti-gravity, was positioned over my table and switched on. The table rose in the air, and the men guided it through the doorway and into the corridor beyond. It seemed that although the table now had no apparent weight, it still had inertia and momentum, although that meant nothing to me. Care was still needed that no damage should take place. That did matter to me. Carefully, the table and associated equipment was towed or pushed down the metal corridor with its distorted echoes and out of the vessel of space. We came into the great rock chamber again, and there was about me the sounds of a great concourse of people, reminding me of the forecourt of the Cathedral of Lhasa in happier days. My table was moved along, and at last was swung about and lowered the few inches to the floor. To my side came a person who whispered, "The Surgeon General will be with you in a moment." I spoke back, "Are you not going to give me sight?" but he had gone, and my requests went unheeded. I lay there trying to picture in my mind all that was happening. I had just the memory of the brief glimpse I had had previously, but I greatly desired that the artificial sight would be provided. Familiar footsteps echoed on the rocky floor. "Ah, they have brought you safely. Do you feel all right?" asked the doctor, the Surgeon General. "Sir Doctor," I replied, "I would feel much better if you would permit me to see." "But you are blind, and you must get used to being blind. You'll have to live a very long time in that state." "But, Sir Doctor," I said, in some considerable exasperation, "how am I to learn and memorize all these wonders which you promised I would see, if you will not provide me with that artificial sight?" "Leave it to us," he answered. "We will ask the questions and give the orders. You just do as you are told." There now came upon the crowd around me a hush, not a silence, for there cannot be a silence where people are congregated. In the hush I could distinguish very sharp footsteps, which ceased abruptly. "Be seated," commanded a curt military voice. There was a relaxed rustling, the rustling of stiff cloth, the creak of leather, and the shuffling of many feet. A scraping sound, as though one of those strange seats had been pushed back, the sound of a man rising to his feet. A tense, expectant hush pervaded the place for a second or so, and then the voice spoke. "Ladies and gentlemen," carefully enunciated this deep, mature voice, "our Surgeon General considers that this native is now sufficiently recovered in health and indoctrinated so that he may, without undue risk, be prepared with the knowledge of the past. There is a risk, of course, but we must face it. If the creature dies, then we must again resume tedious search for another. This native is in poor condition physically. Let us therefore hope that his will is strong and his hold on life firm." I felt my flesh creep at this callous disregard of my feelings, but the voice went on. "There are those among us who consider that we should use only written records revealed to some messiah or saint whom we have placed upon this world for that purpose. But I say that these records have in the past given a superstitious reverence which has nullified their benefits because they have so often been misconstrued, misinterpreted. The natives have not sought the meaning contained within the writings, but have taken their face value alone, and often falsely interpreted face value at that. Frequently it has harmed their development, and has set up an artificial caste system under which certain of the natives assume that they have been chosen by higher powers to teach and preach that which was not written. They have no real conception of us of outer space. Our patrol ships, when sighted, are deemed to be various natural celestial objects or mere hallucinations on the part of the beholders, who are therefore mocked, and their sanity is frequently questioned. They believe that man is made in the image of God, and therefore there cannot be life greater than man. They have the firm conviction that this puny world is the only source of life, not knowing that the inhabited worlds are greater in number than the grains of sand upon the whole world, and that their world is one of the smallest and most insignificant. They believe that they are the masters of creation, and all the animals of the world are theirs to prey upon, yet their own lifespan is but the twinkling of an eye. Compared to us, they are as the insect which lives but for a day and has to be born, grown to adulthood, mate and mate again, and die all within hours. Our average lifespan is 5,000 years. Theirs is a few decades. And all this, ladies and gentlemen, has been brought about by their peculiar beliefs and by their tragic misconceptions. For this reason, they have been ignored by us in the past, but now our wise ones say that in the span of half a century, these natives will discover some of the secrets of the atom. They may thereby blow up their little world. Dangerous radiations may escape into space and constitute a threat of pollution. As most of you know, the wise ones have decreed that a suitable native be caught, and we've caught this one, and his brain to be treated whereby he may remember all we are going to teach him. He will be so conditioned that he can reveal this only to one whom we shall, in due time, place upon this world with the task of telling all who will listen to the facts and not the fancies of others in worlds beyond this small universe. This native, a male, has been specially prepared and will be the recipient of the message which has to be transmitted later to another. The strain will be very great. He may not live through it. So, let us all think strength to him, for if his life ends upon this table, then we have again to commence our search for another, and that, as we have found, is tedious. A crew member has protested that we should take a native from a more developed country, one who enjoys high standing among his fellows, but we believe that that would be a false move. To indoctrinate such a native and let him loose among his fellows would be to ensure his immediate discreditment among others of his kind, and would seriously delay our program. You, all of you who are here, are going to be permitted to witness this recall of the past. It is rare indeed, so remember, you are being favored above others. No sooner had this great one ceased to speak before there came a strange rustling and creaking, and then a voice. But what a voice! It sounded unhuman. It sounded neither male nor female. Hearing it, I felt my hair rise and the little pimples formed on my flesh. As senior biologist, responsible neither to the Navy nor the Army, rasped this most unpleasant voice, I desire to put on record my disapproval of these proceedings. My full report will be forwarded to headquarters in due course. I now demand to be heard here. There seemed to be a sort of resigned gasp from all those assembled. There was, for a moment, much fidgeting, and then the first speaker rose to his feet. As admiral of this fleet, he remarked dryly, I am in charge of this supervisory expedition, no matter what specious arguments emanate from our disgruntled senior biologist. However, let us hear once again the arguments of the opposition. You may continue, biologist. Without a word of thanks, Without the usual formal salutation, the drawling, rasping voice continued. I protest at the waste of time. I protest that we should use any more endeavors on these faulty creatures. In the past, when a race of them were unsatisfactory, they were exterminated, and the planet receded. Let us save time and work, and exterminate them now, before they pollute space. The Admiral broke in. And have you any specific suggestions as to why they are faulty, biologist? Yes, I have, the biologist remarked angrily. The females of the species are faulty. Their fertility mechanism is at fault. Their auras do not conform to that which was planned. We caught one recently from which is referred to as one of the better areas of this world. She screeched and fought when we removed the clothing with which she was swathed, and when we inserted a probe into her body to analyze her secretions, she became first hysterical and then unconscious. Later, conscious again, she saw some of my assistants, and the sight deprived her of her sanity, or of such of it as she possessed. We had to destroy her, and all our work for days was lost. The old hermit ceased to speak and took a sip of water. The young monk sat almost stupefied with horror at the strange things he had heard, at the strange things which had happened to his superior. Some of the descriptions were, in a way, strangely familiar. He could not say how, but the hermit's remarks evoked strange stirrings, stirrings as though suppressed memories were being revived, as though the hermit's remarks were indeed a catalyst. Carefully, without spilling a drop, the ancient man set his bowl of water by his side, folded his hands together, and resumed. I was upon that table. I heard and understood every word. All fear, all uncertainty left me. I would show these people how a priest of Tibet could live or die. My natural rashness constrained me to utter loudly, "See, Sir Admiral, your biologist is less civilized than we, for we do not kill even those who might be termed inferior animals. We are the civilized ones." For a moment, the whole of time stood still. Even the breathing of those about me seemed to stop. Then, to my profound amazement, and indeed shock, there came spontaneous applause and not a few laughs. People smacked their hands together, which I understood was a sign of approval among them. People uttered cries of delight, and some technician near me bent and muttered, "Good for you, monk, good for you. Now say no more. Don't chance your luck." The Admiral spoke, saying, "The native monk has spoken. He has demonstrated to my satisfaction that he is indeed a sentient creature and fully capable of completing the task allotted to him. And I fully endorse his remarks and will embody them in my own report to the wise ones." The biologist snapped out sharply, "I will withdraw from the experiment." With that, the creature, he, she, or it, made a very noisy withdrawal from the rock chamber. There was a collective sigh of relief. Obviously, the senior biologist was not a person in great favor. The murmur died down in response to some manual admonition which I could not see. There came a slight shuffling of feet and the rustling of paper. The air of expectancy was almost tangible. "Ladies and gentlemen," came the voice of the Admiral, "now that we have disposed of objections and interruptions, I propose to say a few words for the benefit of those of you who are fresh to this supervisory station. Some of you have heard rumors, but rumors are never reliable. I am going to tell you what will happen, what it is all about, that you may the better appreciate the events in which you will soon participate. The people of this world are developing a technology which, unless checked, may well destroy them. In the process, they will so contaminate space that other infant worlds in this group could adversely be affected. We must prevent that. As you well know, this world and the others in the group are our testing grounds for different types of creatures. As with plants, that which is not cultivated is a weed. In the animal world, one can have thoroughbreds or scrubs. The humans of this world are becoming of the latter category. We who seeded this world with humanoid stock must now ensure that our other stock on other worlds is not endangered. We have before us here a native of this world. He is from a subdivision of a country which is named Tibet. It is a theocracy. That is, it is ruled by a leader who places great importance in the adherence to a religion than he does to politics. In this country, there is no aggression. No one fights for the lands of another. Animal life is not taken except by the lower orders, who almost always, without exception, are native of other countries. Although their religion appears fantastic to us, yet they live it completely and do not molest others, nor do they force their beliefs on others. They are most peaceful and require a great amount of provocation before they will resort to violence. It was therefore thought that here we could find a native with a phenomenal memory which we could even increase, a native in whom we could implant knowledge which has to be passed on to another whom we shall later place upon this world. Some of you may wonder why we cannot tell our representative direct. We cannot do it with complete satisfaction, as it leads to omissions and aberrations. It has been tried on a number of occasions, but never has it been as we wished it to be. As you will later see, we tried it with fair success with the man whom the Earthlings named Moses, but even with him it was not complete, and errors and misunderstandings were prevalent. Now, in spite of our respected senior biologist, we are going to try this system, which has been worked out by the wise ones. Just as their superb scientific skill, millions of Earth years ago, perfected the faster-than-light drive, so have they also perfected a method whereby the Akashic record itself can be tapped. In this system, the person who is within the special apparatus will see all that happened in the past. So far as his impressions will tell him, he will actually live all those experiences. He will see and hear precisely as though he were living in those long bygone days. To him, he will be there. A special extension direct from his brain will enable each of us vicariously to participate. He, you, or should I say we, shall, to all intents and purposes, cease to exist in this time, and will, so far as our feelings, sight, hearing, and emotions, be transferred to those ages past, whose actual life and happenings we shall be experiencing just as here, now, we have been experiencing shipboard life, or life aboard small patrol ships, or working in this world far below the surface in our subterranean laboratories. I do not pretend to understand fully the principles involved. Some of you here know far more of the subject than I. That is why you are here. Others with different duties will know less than I, and it is to them to whom I have been addressing these remarks. Let us remember that we too have some regard for the sanctity of life. Some of you may regard this native of Earth as just another laboratory animal, but as he has demonstrated, he has feelings, he has intelligence, and remember this well. To us, at present, he is the most valuable creature upon this world. That is why he is here. Some have queried, but how will stuffing this creature with knowledge save the world? And the answer is that it will not. The Admiral made a dramatic pause. I could not see him naturally, but I assumed that others also experienced the tension which was overwhelming me. Then he continued, "This world is very sick. We know it is sick. We do not know why. We are trying to find out why. Our first task, then, is to recognize that a state of sickness exists. Second, we must convince the humans here that they are sick. Third, we must induce in them a desire to be cured. Fourth, we must discover precisely what is the nature of the illness. Fifth, we must evolve a curative agent. And sixth, we must persuade the humans to do that which will effect the cure. The sickness is connected with the aura, yet we cannot discover why. Another must come, must be not of this world. For can a blind man see the ailment of his fellows when he too is blind?" That remark gave me quite a jolt. It seemed to me to be contradictory. I was blind, yet I was being chosen for this work. But no, I was not. I was merely to be the repository of certain knowledge. Knowledge that would enable another to function according to the prearranged plan. But the Admiral was speaking again. "Our native, when he is prepared by us, when we have finished with him, will be taken to a place where he can live out the days of, to him, a very long life. He will not be able to die until he has passed on his knowledge. For his years of blindness and solitude, he will have inner peace and the knowledge that he will be doing much for his world. But now we will have a final check on the native's condition, and then we will commence." Now there was considerable but ordered bustle. I sensed people moving swiftly about. My table was grasped, raised, and moved forward. Then came the, by now familiar, tinkle and chink of glassware and metal came into contact. The Surgeon General came to me and whispered, "How are you now?" I hardly knew how I was or where I was, so I merely responded by saying, That which I have heard has not made me feel any better, but do I still have no sight? How am I to experience these wonders if you will not give me sight once again?" "Just relax," he whispered soothingly. "Everything will be all right. You will see in the best possible way at the right moment." He paused a moment while some other person came and addressed a remark to him, then continued, "This is what will happen. We shall draw upon your head that which to you will appear to be a hat made of wire mesh. It will appear cold until you become accustomed to it. Then we shall put upon your feet articles which you may interpret as wire sandals. We already have wires going to your arms. You will first experience some strange and quite possibly uncomfortable tingling, but that will soon pass. You will have no further discomfort. Rest assured that we will take every possible care of you. This means a very great deal to all of us. We all want it to be a great success. There is too much to lose for it to be a failure." "Yes," I muttered, "I stand to lose more than any. I stand to lose my life." The Surgeon General stood up and turned away from me. "Sir," he said in a very official tone of voice, "the native has been examined and is now ready. Permission requested to proceed." "Permission granted," replied the grave voice of the Admiral. "Proceed." There came a sharp click and a muttered exclamation. Hands grasped me behind the neck and raised my head. Other hands pulled what seemed to be a metal bag of soft wire over my head, over my face, and then they fumbled beneath my chin. There were three strange pops, and the metal bag was tightly over me and fastened around my neck. The hands moved away. Other hands, meanwhile, were at my feet. Some strange, greasy, evil-smelling lotion was rubbed in, and then two metal bags were pulled around my feet. I was not at all used to having my feet thus constrained, and it was truly most unpleasant. Yet there was nothing I could do. The air of expectancy, of tenseness, was growing. In the cave, the old hermit suddenly toppled over backwards. For a long moment, the young monk sat in petrified horror. Then, galvanized into action by the emergency, he jumped to his feet and scrambled beneath a rock for a special medicine placed there in preparation for just such an occurrence. Wrenching out the stopper with hands that shook somewhat, he dropped to his knees beside the old man and forced a few drops of the liquid between his slack lips. Very carefully, so as not to spill a single drop, he replaced the stopper and laid aside the container. Cradling the hermit's head in his lap, he gently stroked the old man's temples. Gradually, a faint trace of color returned. Gradually, there came signs that he was recovering. At last, quaveringly, the old hermit put out his hand and said, "Ah, you are doing very well, my boy, you are doing very well. I must rest a while." "Venerable one," said the young monk, "just rest here. I will make you some hot tea. We will have a little sugar and butter left." Tenderly, he placed his folded blanket under the old man's head and rose to his feet. "I will put the water on to boil," he said, reaching for the can, which was yet half full of water. It was strange, out in the cold air, to reflect upon the marvelous things he had heard. Strange, because so much of it was familiar. familiar but forgotten. It was like waking from a dream, he thought, only this time memories were flooding back instead of fading away, as does a dream. The fire was aglow. Quickly he tossed on handfuls of small twigs. Dense blue clouds rose and billowed in the air. A vagrant breeze swirling around the mountainside twisted a tendril of smoke over the young monk and sent him back reeling and coughing and with eyes streaming. Recovered, he carefully placed the can in the heart of the now bright fire. Turning, he re-entered the cave to make sure that the hermit was recovering. The old man was laying on his side, obviously very much in better health. "We will have some tea and a little barley," he said, "and then we shall rest until the morrow, for I must conserve my waning strength, lest I fail and leave my task uncompleted." The young monk dropped to his knees beside his elder and looked down at the thin, wasted form. "It shall be as you say, Venerable One," he remarked. "I came in to make sure that you were all right. Now I will fetch the barley and see about making the tea." He rose swiftly and moved to the end of the cave to get the sparse supplies. Gloomily, he looked at the small amount of sugar left in the bottom of the bag. Even more gloomily, he examined the remnants of the butter block. Of tea, there was an adequate supply. It had merely to be knocked off the brick and the worst of the twigs and leaves picked out. The barley, too, was in sufficient supply. The young monk resolved to do without sugar and without butter so that the old one should have enough. Outside the cave, the water was bubbling merrily in the can. The young monk dropped in the tea and stirred it vigorously, and then added a small lump of borax to make it taste better. By now, the light of day was fading. The sun was setting fast. There was much work to be done yet, though. More firewood had to be fetched, more water, and he had not been out all day for any exercise. Turning, he hastened back into the dimming cave. The old hermit was sitting up and waiting for his tea. Sparingly, he sprinkled a little barley in his bowl, dropped in a small pat of butter, and then held out the bowl for the young man to fill up with tea. "This is more luxury than I have had in more than 60 years," he exclaimed. "I think I can be forgiven for having something hot after all these years. I could never manage a fire alone. Tried it just once and set my robe on fire. Yes, I have a few scars on my body from those flames, but they healed. Too many weeks, but they healed. Oh well, that comes of trying to pamper oneself." He sighed heavily and sipped the tea. "You have one advantage, Venerable One," laughed the young monk. "Light and dark mean nothing to you. In this darkness, I have just upset my tea through not being able to see it." "Oh," exclaimed the old man, "here, have mine." "No, no, Venerable One," replied the young man affectionately. "We have plenty. I will just pour myself some more." For a time they sat in companionable silence until the tea was all gone. Then the young monk rose to his feet and said, "I will now go and get more water and firewood. May I take your bowl that I may clean it?" Into the now empty water can went the two bowls as the younger man made his way out of the cave. The old hermit sat erect, waiting, just waiting, as he had waited for many decades past. The sun had now set. Only the upper peaks of the mountains were still bathed in golden light. light which turned to purple even as the young monk watched. Deep in the shadowed flanks of the mountain range, small specks of light appeared, one by one. The butter lamps of far distant lamasaries gleaming through the cold, clear air of the plain of Lhasa. The shadowed outline of Drepung Lamasery loomed like a walled city lower down the valley. Here, on the mountainside itself, the young man could look out over the city, the lamasaries, and watch the gleaming, happy river. Far away on the other side, the Patala and Iron Mountain were still imposing, in spite of the apparent diminution of size through the great distance. But there was no time to waste. The young monk scolded himself in shocked surprise at his slowness and hasted off along the darkening path to the edge of the lake. Quickly he washed and scoured the two bowls and the water can. Hastily he scooped the can full of clean water and set off along the path back, dragging with him the large branch which previously he had been too laden to handle. Stopping for a moment to regain his breath, for the branch was very large and heavy, he looked back towards the mountain pass leading to India. There glowed afar the flickering light which must denote a caravan of traders encamped for the night. No trader ever traveled by night. The young man's heart leaped. Tomorrow the traders would wend their slow way along the mountain trail and would no doubt make their camp at the lakeside before going on to Lhasa the day after. Tea, butter, the young man grinned to himself and took up his burden renewed. Venerable one, he called as he entered the cave with the water. There are traders on the pass. Tomorrow we may have butter and sugar. I will keep close watch for them. The old man chuckled as he remarked, yes, but for now we sleep. The young man helped him to his feet and placed his hand on the wall. Shakily, he went off to the inner compartment. The young man lay down and scooped the depression for his hip bone. For some time he lay there thinking of all that he had heard. Was it true that humans were weeds? Just experimental animals? No, he thought. Some of us are doing our best in very difficult circumstances, and our hardships were to encourage us to do better, climb upwards, for there is always room at the top. So thinking, he fell into a sound sleep. End of chapter 6.